one guy was like, do you know ramen?
And I'm like, you know what I'm talking about. Whatever that guy's name is.
Oh, we got a packed house.
Sure is, buddy.
I'll be really disappointed.
But hey, if you've got obligations,
I understand.
I do. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you.
Who? About this? About the what? Jail? No.
Oh, about the people. Yeah. I know what you're talking about. About people dying in the jail, I assume.
I don't know what
I'm having to do.
We are on the
committee.
That's it?
No.
Councilman Arias. It'd be nice of you to maybe sit down.
Let's have this meeting.
Yes. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Councilman Jimmy Peluso. I'm holding this notice meeting with Councilman Raul Arias to talk about the J bill, and luckily we have been joined by Councilman Rahman Johnson. Thank you both for being here today. Do you have any opening statements you'd like to make?
Good afternoon. Raul Arias, District 11. No opening statements. I'm just excited to have a full room for this, my first meeting, so thank you all for joining us today.
And thank you, Councilman Peluso and Councilman Arias. Of course, when I saw it was a J bill, I wanted to come. Rahman Johnson again, District 14. And just want to be here to offer some input. I'm going to stay as long as I can. As you know, we have council meeting coming up in just a moment. So glad to be here.
Understood. And I really do want to thank both of you for making the time to come down here. This is an important piece of legislation that's kind of been put before us. I think there's been a lot of moving pieces recently, so I just kind of wanted to get your insights on it. And yours in particular, given that you're a restaurateur yourself. Now, what I first want to say is this J bill, if you both are not familiar with the J bill process, this is basically a request of the city council to our Duval delegation, right? The folks that are up in Tallahassee. So it's basically, hey, city council is asking you guys to run a piece of legislation for the betterment and for the interests of the city of Jacksonville. So this piece of legislation was brought to me by Build Up Downtown, and we have the executive director of Build Up Downtown, Alan DeVault, here today, and he's going to speak momentarily, I believe. And I'm also the one carrying it, not just because I have the downtown area, but I was also the vice chair of the Critical Quality of Life Committee for Changing Homelessness. So I've already kind of been working in a space on a volunteer basis involving homelessness and the unhoused. Separately, and I know you kind of sat in, Councilman Arias, you sat in, and I don't know if you sat in much of it, but when Councilman Boylan gave sort of his very quick, down and dirty, 1-hour-long briefing of how the Critical Quality of Life committee meetings went last year, one of the things that was brought before the committee and is placed into the recommendations that the report that was filed was that it would be great and it's needed and it's recommended that we have a dedicated funding source for a homeless trust or for programs to support the unhoused. Because currently right now we don't have any real city money going to any sort of, whether it be the nonprofit space or the government space, to do much for the unhoused. Almost all of our money is pass-through money from either the federal government or from the state of Florida. So this is kind of putting a little more skin in the game. From the city's perspective, and obviously we see it every day as we come into downtown. You see it in all of our districts. The number of unhoused individuals is very troubling, and we need resources to help ensure that we are putting ourselves in a position where we can do more to get more people off the streets. Not only is it a social ill to have this much homelessness in our city, especially in the 21st century, one of the wealthiest countries on earth, but also it's an economic detriment. So I wanted to have Mr. DeVault come up here and sort of speak on what the J bill is requesting of the Duval delegation. Alan?
Thank you, and thank you for having me here. I think you summed it up really well, but you know, the point is the J bill is just changing some wording at a state level that would allow Duval County to opt in at a later time by vote of city council to a potential local option food and beverage tax, so 15% or more of which would go to help victims of domestic violence, and the remainder would go toward housing, as well as job training and other support services, mental health services for the homeless. So this is, in my mind, kind of the first phase to open up the opportunity to have a larger conversation about it when we do, if we were to get to that point and determine if it is a tool that we want to use. Again, like you mentioned, the CQLI had mentioned a permanent source of funding should be found, and this is one option to do so. If it's not the right option after a longer conversation, perhaps, and there's other options, we'd love to have it. But the way the state law is written, Duval County doesn't even have the option to consider this at this point. So a J bill is a local bill that would change that wording to allow us to address it later. But there's been a lot of questions. I'm happy to answer any questions, certainly.
Please, if you don't mind, I just want to make a point of clarification. So, yeah, so this J bill is just requesting that the Duval delegation pushes to ensure we have the opportunity for, at a later date, to potentially have some sort of food and beverage tax.
Correct.
But it certainly does not say that City Council wants to increase taxes, nor does it say that we want the Duval delegation to increase taxes. Correct?
Absolutely. Okay. It just... I mean, currently the way 212036 is worded, it says any county as defined by 125.011 may impose by the approval of their elected council or commission at a later time. This would change in, because 125011 effectively only names Dade County and I think maybe Hillsborough. This would add Duval to the option to later consider it and impose it.
And right now Miami-Dade is the only county that currently has the right to do this.
The only one in Florida that does.
Are we seeing, and I know we have Don Gilman in the audience as well, perhaps you can kind of speak to some of the work on the Critical Quality of Life Committee, as well as sort of some of the things that Miami-Dade are doing, unless you have questions real quick for the speaker.
You have a lot of questions.
Please.
Do I push this one?
I think you're recording. I think it's
already recording. Yeah. All right.
You just don't have a very loud voice.
All right. So you mentioned Miami-Dade County, correct? Is there a reason why Miami-Dade County at that time was the only county that was that had this introduced?
From my understanding, I spoke with a gentleman named Ron Book, who was pushing it in the 90s, and I also spoke with former Congressman Crenshaw, who was in the state Senate at that time. And it was Miami-Dade County had 8,000 unsheltered homeless people at that time by their count, and they saw a need for some permanent funding at that point. So they had discussed this as an option, and they brought it to the state first to put it in statutorily in 1992. And then in 1993, they created a task force to further look at the law and how it could affect their community. And then it wasn't until 1994 that they actually passed the local ordinance that imposed it. But at that point, it was only a Miami-Dade thing. And it was the first in the country at the time, and currently the only in Florida.
94, 2023, so you're looking at, you know, roughly, what, 30 years? So I ask this because why are we the only, why are they the only ones in Florida? And I say we because I'm from Miami, but either way, why is Miami the only one in Florida currently right now? And why was it only food and beverage?
I don't know that I could speak to why only Miami-Dade. I think that my understanding is some of the providers up here have known about this for some years, and they just haven't been able to get it to a point to change the wording. And so we're to that point now. I'm not sure if any other counties in the state have had conversations. I've done exhaustive research, but mostly in what's happened and can be found, you know, for, you know, ordinances or things that have passed. As far as food and beverage, you know, we have a meeting call set up with them in a week with Mr. Book and the Homelessness Trust to kind of get a little bit more information about that. But I know at the time, you know, the food and beverage industry down in Miami, certainly, as you are well know, is a very robust business, and it, probably even in the 90s. And why they chose that particular industry to do, you know, to impose this, I can't speak to that comfortably.
Right.
But
All right. So, yes, she could continue.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Alan.
Sure.
We need him. We could call him back.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. This is a very free-form type of meeting. Don, if you wouldn't mind kind of speaking towards what the Critical Quality of Life Committee discussed and what you kind of know about how Miami-Dade does it and kind of why they did it this way and why it's good, bad, ugly, or whatever else.
Okay. Don Gilman, I'm the CEO of Changing Homelessness. Thanks for having me. The Critical Quality of Life, I was asked to help put forward different models that different communities across the country that were successful, what did they use? What are different options to create an ongoing funding stream to help address the issue of homelessness and the unhoused in our community? We asked communities outside of the state. We were specifically asked to bring in one that was an example in Florida. The only really good example in Florida is Miami-Dade. As Alan talked about 25, 30 years ago, they passed this ordinance. Miami-Dade has been very successful in being able to bring down the number of people who are unhoused within that county. They have also been able to leverage this continuing reliable funding source to be able to do things that other large communities within the state have not. A couple interesting examples that they have been able to do to secure more housing and move more people off the streets and into stable housing, because they are able to predict the amount of money that they're going to get in any given year from this tax, they've been able to partner with their different housing authorities. Any public housing that is in disrepair and the public housing authority does not have funding to repair, they are able to go in, make the unit habitable again, and then the homeless trust, their coordinated entry system, they have the right to directly put a homeless individual to end that person's homelessness by putting them into that unit. They're able to add on other services that the federal funding that both Jacksonville and Miami have does not cover. So they're able to have more robust services for mental health. They're able to add layer on other services that maybe things the grant doesn't quite pay for. They have, I would say, a much more comprehensive street outreach team and focus on moving people directly off the streets and into housing. And they've been able to increase the number of units that they have available in any given month through leveraging this opportunity and the other funding streams that are available to any entity that does this type of work.
Do you have any questions?
Not right now.
I did want to ask real quick, what there's a major military installation down in the Miami-Dade area. It's the headquarters for SOUTHCOM, so I envision that veteran homelessness is probably a major issue down there. Has that been a major, have we seen a major decrease in veteran homelessness down in the Miami-Dade area?
Yes, they are the only major community in the state of Florida that has been. There's a very small federal entity called the Interagency Council on Homelessness. They designate if a community reaches something called functional homelessness, which means you have the ability to identify and assist anyone within a subcategory within 30 days and get them, essentially 30 days to get them rehoused. Miami-Dade has reached that criteria. So they have, it's effective in ending of veteran homelessness. They have met that criteria and they've been able to maintain it.
And they're the only county of all 67 counties in the state of Florida?
Yes. We have come close at different times in Duval County, but we have been unable to sustain that level to be able to continue to rehouse as many veterans as fall into homelessness in any given month.
Excellent. Thank you. Do you have any questions?
This program, I know Alan mentioned 85% and 15% earlier. Is there any percentage allocated to just the veteran population?
There is not. And this is probably going to be part of, should this go forward, this is going to be part of the critical discussion that we have within our community. If what funding already comes into our community, either from the federal, state, or other philanthropic areas, specifically for different subpopulations. Right now, the veteran, the VA, on the federal level, provide substantially more funding for a relatively small pool of people who are veterans who are experiencing homelessness versus HUD, who provides through a different continuum of care grant for anybody who is homeless. So we have brought the percentage of veterans, we're under 7% of people experiencing homelessness in Duval County are veterans. So we've brought it down from about 25% down to 7%. We have about an equal amount of money for veterans as we do for everybody else.
If I may, so with potentially some of these monies that we can leverage that to get more grants that are specifically targeted to support veteran homelessness and veteran homelessness, correct?
We can. We can also, as a community, we may choose with this money, we want to see, our goal is a 50% decrease in people living on the streets, mm-hmm. right? So would there be enough money to do that? How would we put those programs together? We as a community may also say, we don't think any child should ever sleep on the street. How do we address that? How many are there today? What sort of programs do we need? How do we effectively do that? There's the big population, people who are unhoused, anyone who is literally sleeping in a place not meant for human habitation. And there are different subpopulations we look at as your lead agency. And we're happy, as we go forward with this, and any questions that you may have, we're happy to provide that information on who we're seeing. From my perspective, should this move forward, I think as a community, the most critical piece of this is ensuring as few people as possible ever sleep on our streets. It costs us more as a community to walk by someone who is experiencing street homelessness and is chronically homeless than it would for us to house them with full wraparound services. It's just right now we're paying for it in different silos, through the sheriff's office, through hospitals, through crisis stabilization units, through our emergency shelters, where we would, when we house someone, we're looking at that program and we can get the actual per person cost per year to do that.
Okay. So you mentioned we brought down the veteran rate from 25 to 7% currently.
Mm-hmm.
What is the population right now in general here in Jacksonville for the homeless?
Number of veterans or total?
Altogether.
Right now on our by-name list, there's over 3,000 individuals that are currently seeking, that are homeless and are seeking assistance.
3,000. Okay. In Miami-Dade County, what is the percentage for veterans?
I do not know that off the top
of my
head.
I like to compare them.
Yeah.
Both Miami-Dade County and Jacksonville, because I do understand that Miami-Dade County, like you said, has made significant improvements, right? But I would like to still compare the percentages-wise, not necessarily quantify the bodies, the units, but the percentage, because that's what dictates the city, right? So I'd like to compare both of them just to see how the programs are working, how effective they really are in that sense, right?
And I'm happy to reach out to my counterparts in Miami-Dade and get just what their total by-name list is right now and what their percentage of veterans, and if there's any other group that you're especially interested in, we can work with them on getting that and ours and give you a percentage comparison.
I homelessness, I mean, it's something that we all, everybody in this room really cares deeply about, I would say. So this is something that we can't neglect and we can't just sweep under the rug. We have to do something drastic at some point about it. But, the point of this conversation is to have a conversation to find solutions towards this, right? And so thank you for addressing all that. And want to take it to the next step now.
Thank you. I did want to recognize we do have Michael Corrigan in the room, and he probably didn't expect me to call him up here, but he is the CEO of Visit Jacksonville. And if you have a quick minute, I just want to see if you could maybe speak to from a tourism and business standpoint, do you feel like you've heard from vendors and businesses here in the downtown area or around our city, is homelessness something that you think is kind of holding us back in some ways?
Sure. Michael Corrigan, Visit Jacksonville council member. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you this afternoon. Sure. I mean, especially downtown, our hotels, our hotel properties, contact us periodically and ask for assistance and advice on how to address this issue. Just like the other council member just said, we're all concerned and we all want to help. They look at it from twofold. One, how can they help? And then how can they make non-addressed individuals less of a of a notice to the visitors that come in town? I mean, every DMO, every destination marketing organization around the country is trying to assist with this. Some do in one way, some way, and some do in others. I by no means have read this enough today to be able to tell you a position that we're in, but we appreciate being part of the conversation and want to continue to be part of the conversation as this makes its way through to understand. We have to make sure we understand, is there a detrimental effect on tourism from the tax side of this or not? And we have to determine that as we have these conversations.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Any questions, council members?
Thank you.
I guess one of the concerns, I guess it's not really a question, council members and former Councilman Corrigan.
I'm glad you got that position now, not me. You can have 14. I had that before.
There's also our tax collector. Let's not get him off the hook.
We can just call y'all kind of names.
The reason we had to pay was because of this man right here.
I was somewhat popular when I came in. Not so popular walking out.
So I guess one of the things, while I'm certainly not trying to find yet another tax, and honestly, this will be a way, and that's why I wanted to kind of hear your views, Councilman Arias, being that you are a restaurateur in our city. One of the things that I think is, and I think it was mentioned earlier, is the fact that you have so many organizations that already do this work that are not speaking to each other. So is the answer yet another tax and yet more money on top of money, or is it what do we need to do to make sure that these organizations connect? The good thing about it is if this does, which I would not be opposed to this, but I'm glad that there's a check in it, whereas the city council will have to vote to impose a tax if there is one that comes up. But this is just what concerns me, that we would just do a tax for the sake of doing a tax, have yet more money that we would then dole out to separate organizations who would go into their corners and spend the money, and the problem is still not rectified.
Did you want to kind of speak to that, Don? Thank you, Mr. Corrigan.
I think one of the unique things about the original wording of the state legislation is should this tax be imposed, it can only be spent on what is in that community's plan. So to address your initial concern, it's not a bunch of different agencies that never speak to one another. There is a very robust communication between agencies. There is, when I talk about the number of people who are experiencing homelessness, that comes, we have agencies that report into a database on the people that they see in outreach, the people they're helping with housing services, all those services, so we know what is happening on the ground. There are some agencies that that choose not to put into that database. There are some agencies that go after, if you go after federal funding, you are required to put into that database. I guess the point I'm trying to make is there is actually a large, well-organized group of agencies who are working to address and end homelessness. We are using every dollar that we get from every resource to its maximum extent. We don't have anything else to address the increase that we're seeing on the streets. We know through that data that right now probably on our downtown streets there's about 200 individuals who are 55 and older with a diagnosed disability who have been homeless for over a year. They absolutely qualify for something called permanent supportive housing. We don't have enough resources available to move them into housing.
If I may, just to dig a little deeper.
Of course.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess we don't have to do this informal now.
Just talk and speak your questions.
Right. I guess I'm a little bit concerned that when you say resources, you don't mean funding resources. You mean manpower resources that you don't have. And then the database. What is that called? And is this group, because it doesn't, I mean, I guess End Homelessness would be the group that's doing it. But, like, is there, it seems like there are organizations like Claire White Mission or Catholic Charities or these other groups. Are they doing it together? Because you just said these organizations, but then you said they're not working in silos. So it's a little bit incongruent for me.
So about 50 years ago, my organization was founded to be the connector between those. There's about 40 different organizations in Duval Clay and Nassau County, the majority in Duval County, who are working to end and prevent homelessness. They all choose to be member agencies. They all choose to put that data in the database, and we work on what our prioritization is. That is one of the things as when we talk about homelessness and the fact that we don't have enough resources. It is both, it's resources to hire people to work with people. That's one of the ways we work directly with people to help them move off the streets and into housing. It's also that resources for the housing. It has, anyone who lives in Duval County has seen the news reports. All of us have had people affected by the increase in rents and home prices throughout our county. So our organizations are also facing that struggle. So yes, Clara White member, Clara White Mission is one of the founding members of the coalition. Catholic Charities, Sulzbacher, Jewish Family, Ability Housing, and of course I'm up here, my mind just blanked on more of those, but yes, those are all active member organizations who do different parts and pieces. There is no single entity in the county or in the country that's going to do it all. We all try to work on what we do best and maximize those efforts.
And if I may, Councilman Johnson, I mean, we all know that there are individuals living on the street. We walk by them every day. To think that we have organizations that are just saying, oh, you know, well, I'm going to operate in a silo and not try to help those individuals seems kind of odd to me. I think that we have certainly seen in the past number of years that one of the issues is the lack of housing opportunities for folks, and especially ones that are affordable. We already know that, and I know Cindy Funkhauser is not here, but she at Sulzbacher is building their second phase to their Sulzbacher Village. They do need more resources to make sure that gets across the finish line. But I mean, that's a number of units that could be used for the unhoused. And I mean, I remember during the critical quality of life meetings that we had, and I believe it was you and Councilman Nick Allen. He was the chair. You were vice chair. And I remember you said that you could put, you can get 200 of the most chronically homeless individuals, those that are on the street, we know them, we see them, we can recognize them all the time, and you can get those 200 off the street for less money than what we spend on.
In case you're wondering, it would cost about $5 million a year, each year, to house those individuals, the chronically homeless individuals. So these are people with either a physical disability, a mental health illness, or a substance use issue, or two or three of the above. That is something that is we're able to quantify. It costs us on average twice as much to walk by them if we calculate in any time there's a 911 call, they're transported by ambulance, they go into hospital, they go into jail, they crisis stable. There's different things that they cycle through to try to get the help that they need. Whereas as a human being, it's Maslow's hierarchy of needs, food, clothing, and shelter.
Yep.
If you can take care of that, you're able then to work on other things that you need to do after that. But that being able to have a safe place with a door that can lock, that you can prepare your own food, that you have a bed, that is critical for someone to be able to function. Yep.
Go ahead.
I do have a couple other questions. Well, how much time do we have left?
We technically have hit 4:30, but as long as you want to continue to go.
I have now questions pertaining to the actual text right now.
Okay.
So I
do real quick. I want to recognize we have Chair Wyman Duggan here in the room, State Representative. Thank you so much for joining us, sir.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Mr. Corrigan and to Alan, I have questions for both you gentlemen. First, I'll start with Mr. Corrigan.
7:30.
We're talking about tourism dollars, right? Well, not tourism dollars, but tourism in general. And Alan, maybe you know this answer more than I do, or more than he does. I don't know. But when it comes to the vast population of the homelessness, somebody alluded to it of downtown, the issue in downtown. And I get that. So obviously, it's countywide, but the main issue is downtown, right? These taxpayer dollars, right, this pass-through, should it go through, right, where would it be used primarily at? Downtown?
I mean, I think that's more of a function of the trust that would be put together as to where it would be. Talking with Ms. Gilman and Funkhauser, They think about 50% of our homeless are downtown. The rest are scattered throughout the community, from Mandarin to the beaches to certainly Riverside, Avondale, and other areas. But it is all over. But the funds would be used for the entire county, or accessible for the entire county.
Okay. So in Miami-Dade County, is this tax imposed to all of Miami-Dade County or to certain sectors of, like, Miami Beach, for example?
So in the 90s, when this tax was imposed, they specifically carved out three municipalities, Miami Beach, Surfside, and Ball Harbor, I believe, because they already had a pre-existing resort tax, which was 2%, and so they carved those three municipalities out from either the very beginning or soon thereafter, so those three don't. But as it would turn out, Miami Beach has recently chosen to impose their impose the tax, the 1%, on Miami Beach itself. So in 2021, the citizens of Miami Beach did a straw poll that passed by 54% to impose it. So then the commission then voted to have that taken to Tallahassee so they could fix that wording and allow Miami Beach to opt in. And this past session, they did include language in 212036 that said any municipality that was carved out because of a resort tax could opt in to the tax by way of a voter referendum. So Miami Beach will then have to do another voter referendum this year to impose that on themselves. I have not heard anything about Surfside or Ball Harbor.
Okay, and so these questions that I'm asking are not because I'm against or for anything, just to make sure to everybody, okay? But let's say it were to pass. Can it be the other way around, where we decide which municipalities or which, I guess, areas or districts of Jacksonville will get this tax imposed? Like, for example, downtown hotels and businesses, and not necessarily District 11 or, you know, District 4.
I think that'd be better answered by an attorney, but I would say I don't think so, but I would not want to go on record as knowing that answer. I mean, in the wording says any county as defined may impose additional tax by ordinance adopted by a majority vote of the governing body. And so in the intention is for the county as a whole.
Okay. So now, Mr. Corrigan, this question was for you. Regarding tourism, what would you say is the leading driver to tourism here in Jacksonville?
The
leading driver to bring tourism dollars here to Jacksonville? Is it downtown? Is it the beaches?
It's all over.
What would you say is the number one, aside from the zoo?
Where we market the most or where we spend the most money?
Where we market the most. Spend the most money on tourism dollars.
That's a really tough question to answer.
Would you say is downtown?
We have two separate marketing campaigns. One is for meetings and one is for leisure. Meetings, 100%, I could say downtown, but leisure is spread out all through all 840 square miles.
Okay.
And that's because our full service hotels are concentrated downtown.
That's why I ask, you know, because this tax will be imposed onto, it's a pass through, but it will be primarily to hotels and restaurants. And if most of the hotels that are the ones that are, you know, advocating for this, if that's the case, it's downtown, then I just wonder why do we have to pass it on to other restaurants and other hotels outside of downtown? It's my point. As a small business owner, I've been in business for 17 years. My biggest thing is, the service industry. I have a deep passion for it. And once again, it's not for or against anything. But the restaurant industry, hotel industry, all the service industry, we just came out of COVID. Hardest times ever, right? And to get out of COVID, to now deal with inflation, deal with rising labor costs, you see less visitors at the restaurant frequently. When I will see somebody at least twice, three times a week, now they're trying to figure out if they're going to go either a Wednesday or Friday to make sure that they have enough money to pay for that meal. Because as you know very well, you go to lunch, you're not paying $6.99 anywhere for lunch. You're probably paying $12, $14. Two people, you're at $30, $50. That's his lunch, right? And 2% might not seem like a lot, but 2% here, the new standard in tipping in general, and I tip well, but I have a standard I go by, is 20%.
It's on the record that you tip well.
Thank you so much, right? So it used to be 15, then 18, now it's really 20, it's really what it is. So, you know, you have an extra from 18 to 20, 2% there, and then another 2%, you know, pass through on taxes. It gets to a point where it's not a direct hit on the businesses, but it is indirectly affecting all businesses, you know, in the service industry, because consumers now are frequently less than what they would be normally prior to COVID. I keep on bringing Miami up because my concern, Councilman, is that not all cities are created equally. Miami is a consumer-based county. Mm-hmm. Tourism dollars are that's what Florida is. It's Miami and Orlando and who knows what else, right? But I feel that Jacksonville is not at that point, right, to be taxing locals, because at the end of the day, the people that are visiting these restaurants here in Jacksonville are, for the most part, locals. And we're in Miami, you have obviously a good amount of locals, but primarily you have a lot of tourism dollars that are going to be affected by this, which they don't care because they're going there to spend money anyways. And the locals in Miami, like the Brickell and the Wynwood, they could afford $3,000-$4,000 a month in rent for a studio. So they're a consumer-based-driven community where I don't think we're there yet. So to just impose more taxes on that, that's where I kind of have the issue. So I wanted to have this meeting because I wanted to see what other solutions, aside from taxing the restaurants and hotels, are there? Because that's the only one I've heard. Are there any more?
So to that point, and I first want to make a quick point of clarification. So if I'm not mistaken, Alan, this is on – it's for restaurants that are still profitable. They make over $400,000 or more in profit. And then it's a 1% tax on any bill over $100, any check over $100. Is that correct?
That was discussed as a potential option perhaps up in North Florida, but I have not seen that anywhere in the ordinance or the statute. It is for 1% on food, beverage, and alcoholic beverage at restaurants that sell more than $400,000 a year and are licensed by the state of Florida to sell alcohol for on-premise consumption. Okay. So no Paneras, no fast food, and no smaller. I think that to the question earlier, could you adjust portions of this to fit the city? Perhaps that $400,000 revenue number could be something that would be, that was a 1992 number. I could easily see that doubled. And I think perhaps that's something that could be done locally. Don't quote me. But then the 2% is on only food, beverage, and alcoholic beverage at hotels and motels. It does not affect the room rate or any other services there, just the food and beverage. And that portion goes toward tourism funding and promotion.
Understood. So, and to the question that you just asked, and this is probably a larger conversation that we should have, and definitely we should have it with Michael, and probably even Councilman Boylan and Councilman Howland, because they were the ones who were kind of leading those efforts in the Critical Quality of Life Committee meetings, the different options for a funding source. I do recall one of them, and Don, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, like some city put out a $200 million bond as a way to kind of fund their homeless trust. But, you know, that the bond means you got to issue more debt. So that's kind of a problem in and of itself. That's not one that I personally love seeing. And then you could just take money out of the general fund. But we, as you and I know, as we're going through the budget process right now, you know, the general fund is stressed for a million other reasons, and there's a million other demands on our city. So to me, a dedicated funding source is always a better option. Go ahead, sorry.
So when it comes to taxing, you know, I just think of, you know, the lesser of two evils, and why not tax tobacco-based products, right? Those kind of taxes where I see more of an approach where people would be more on board to jumping onto that than than an industry, because we're talking about homelessness, but restaurants go out. Most of the people that are working there could be part of that group that will now inflate your population of homelessness, right? So I'm just trying to think of different innovative ideas and not necessarily affecting an industry that has been struggling for the past couple of years and will continue to struggle as it is now. Just to clarify, the $400,000, is that you mentioned net. Is it net or is it sales?
It's annual gross annual revenues.
Gross annual revenues, right? And that's 93, so definitely a difference in that. Because anybody opens up a business, I mean, you're going to pass $400,000 in a heartbeat. Well, these days, with the prices now. Right? So,
and I will say, you know, this J bill just gives us the ability. For one, this J bill, only all it does is tell our delegation, hey, can you please push this in Tallahassee? You know, if it gets through Tallahassee to get signed in by the governor, then from there, we get to decide. If you and I might not be on council by the time this, you know, somebody actually, some council or mayor or both get together and want to pass this. So this really is just giving us another tool in the toolkit for a later date. So you just talked about inflation, COVID, all the different issues that have been facing our economy. I agree with you. You know, this is something that we're not going to do this year. That's for sure. And you and I might not be on. We might be retired. We might be old men by the time this thing gets moved in. But it's about making sure that we have the right and ability to do it later on in life, as a city, you know, as a community. Because right now, you know, we would have to go through this process at some point. We'd have to ask the delegation or the legislature to assist us at some point. Well, let's just do it now because it's already something that we discussed during our critical quality of life committee meetings and recognize that, hey, we could use different resources available to us. So this is us just taking the leadership role and getting one of those resources available to us for a later date. But I agree with you, right? I mean, it's been tough on all sectors of the economy. I was a server many moons ago. I know the restaurant industry well, and I've got family that owns restaurants as well outside the state and inside the state. I do want to say we are at 4:42. You and I have city council at 5. But do you have any closing sort of thoughts?
My last question was, how many in here are hotel owners, restaurant owners? Thank you. I would love to hear their thoughts. I know we're on a time crunch.
I am fine if we want to give everyone.
Can we at least listen to each of you guys at least for a 1.5 minute? Just briefly, I want to hear what you have to say. That's
please.
Okay.
Yeah, it's perfectly fine by me.
Kirit Padida, we represent about 5 hotels in the area in Jacksonville. Served on 2 terms of the TDC and on other committees through FRLA and Visit Jacksonville over the years. 24 years here. Went to middle school in Palatka in 1980. Let's go to the solutions. First and foremost, we have 40 agencies doing whatever they want. We have no absolute numbers. They say we have 3,000 homeless. Mm-hmm. That's 140 people at agency. Where's the money? What's the dissection of that money? Secondly, why the hotel and restaurant? We can do it, okay? Anyone who buys a car in the Duval County, tax them an extra 2 cents, so 2%. That's one solution. Another solution is in a year or so, we're going to renovate the Jacksonville Stadium, where the maintenance fee goes from the TDC, our hotel revenue bed tax, 2% for maintenance and 2% to take care of the bond, as you are well aware. So for 2.5-3 years, you will have a $25 million extra where you're not maintaining a stadium because they're under construction. Use that money. Don't always put it on the backs of the hotels and restaurants. We're tired of it. We're sick and tired of it. I've got 2 more projects I will not build. Even if this goes to Tallahassee, we've got enough Republicans there to take care of that.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. I am going to keep everyone to 1:30. Go ahead, sir.
Alex Patel, hotelier here in Jacksonville. I know you were saying it's a pass-through tax. It's not. At the end of the day, money, it's our bottom line as hoteliers, as restaurateurs. It's money out of our pockets, no matter what you say, even if it's a tax or what. I've got hotels in Alabama, Kentucky, Tennessee, and all over. The cities, municipalities are doing this all over, just constantly taxing the hotels and restaurants and tax. There's people are getting out of the business and shutting down because of this. I mean, it gets crazy that only the hotels and restaurants are paying for stuff in the city. Homelessness is not just the hotel and restaurant problem. It's the whole Duval County problem. I think the solution should be everybody's money, not just one group of people's money here that are affected. I mean, we didn't create it, so why are we paying for it? I'm sympathetic of the situation, but I think everybody here should help out and pitch in. I don't think that it should be done on one group. That's all.
Thank you so much. And thank you all for being quick. I really do appreciate it.
Good afternoon, everyone. everyone. I'm Nicole Chapman with the Florida Restaurant Lodging Association. We represent many of hotels and restaurants in our community and the whole state. We strongly oppose this legislation, this proposed legislation, as a burden to our visitors and residents, as you've all spoken to today. Many of our restaurateurs entertain our locals. Yes, there are some visitors here, but it's really our locals. So we like to work with you guys to figure out some other ideas and opportunities here. But just a reminder, our industry is hurting from COVID and all those things you mentioned. So thank you, guys.
Thank you. Man, that was quick. Is there anyone else that'd like to speak on the matter? Don, please. Oh, I'm sorry.
Can we speak to the restaurant and hotels first? Thank you.
And if you want to speak next, kind of move up a little bit.
I swore I wasn't going to come up here, and here I am. I'm just a small restaurant owner. My wife and I started Blue Orchid a few years ago. We have two locations now. And I can't speak for every restaurant owner, but I will say that I think my opinion on this subject should be very widely shared. And that is, this is a noble cause, and it absolutely deserves attention. But I question whether there aren't other noble causes that are being sidestepped by trying to address this through direct funding. And as a result, we are also setting a precedent whereby such types of taxes might be further implemented in other industries, right? It was a slippery slope that we walked down. And pretty soon, every single little tax will be earmarked for some other little project, okay? So I won't repeat all of the other concerns that everybody mentioned about why restaurants, because this isn't really a restaurant problem. But if this is a situation that deserves attention, and I think it does, then the best case scenario is to find a funding source that benefits from homelessness in some way, that or creates homelessness in some way, just like the cancer and tobacco cessation was through taxing of cigarettes. I don't really know what the answer is. I'm not a politician. But I can tell you that a 1% tax doesn't sound like very much. But I can pretty reliably tell you that customers have a certain amount of money to spend every month, and if a percentage of it goes to taxes, we can fully expect that about 1% of the revenue will disappear. It'll just go to the state instead.
Thank you so much, sir. And also, I love your restaurant.
I'm not going to say that. Never mind. My favorite restaurant is my restaurant, but you have a great restaurant as well.
This is just an answer to the question.
Okay.
Texted my counterpart in Miami. Their percentage of veterans is at 2.5%.
2.5. Perfect. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Oh, and go ahead, Mr. Corrigan.
I just want to thank both council members for taking input from the industry. That's huge. And Visit Jacksonville obviously is ready to help continue this conversation as it goes forward.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who would like to speak on this matter? Seeing none, is there anything else you'd like to say?
If anybody that didn't speak that wants to speak, please email me. We'll set up a meeting on the side because I do really care about this. Like I said, I'm passionate about this, but on both fronts, not just one-sided, right? So I definitely want to keep on here, you know, having more conversations with the community. And Councilman Peluso, thank you for this opportunity today.
My pleasure.
Appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Yeah. Now we got 4 hours of stuff we got to do.
If you haven't, have you said?